This is Healthy Together, presented by RWJ Barnabas Health. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. Visit rwjbh.org to learn more. And now, here's our host, WCBS's Marla Diamond.
Hello, and welcome to the Healthy Together podcast, presented by RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. Today, the story of pioneering modern medicine from the heart. I'm joined by Dr. Margarita Camacho, the Surgical Director of Cardiac Transplantation at RWJ Barnabas Health. Dr. Camacho, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are one of only 200 women in the U.S. to become a board-certified thoracic surgeon. Why did you choose this specialty?
Well, when I was in medical school, I was fascinated by the surgical rotation where I could use my hands to heal. And during my surgical residency, I was fascinated by cardiovascular physiology. And I thought there would be nothing better than to be a cardiac surgeon.
I was hoping that you could detail your journey in medicine as a woman in a male-dominated field.
Yeah, so it was a very interesting one, I must say. In medical school, there were quite a few women. It wasn't as male-dominated during medical school. And in fact, these days, I think over 50% of medical school graduates are women. But the field of surgery is totally different. So back then, and I went to medical school and trained in the 80s into the early 90s, there were very few women in general surgery and even fewer in cardiac surgery. I must say, though, that women in surgery, that wasn't a new concept then, despite the fact that it was years ago. Women had been become surgeons way back in the 60s and 70s at least. So by that time, I would say that although it was male dominated, my male colleagues were very receptive to women. I didn't really encounter any major problems with respect to gender difference. And I will say that by just sheer numbers, there were so many men compared to women. I believe there are over 3,000 male cardiothoracic surgeons and only 200 women. And so most of my mentors actually were men. A few of them were women. And I must say that the women were wonderful when it came to being encouraged to stick with it. Don't give up. As women, we had major time management issues because many of us were the primary caregivers at home and had to take care of household responsibilities. And not all of us, but most of us. And, call it the nurturing part of us or whatever, we worried about it. So to balance those two things was difficult. And I must say, in the women in my peer group who trained at the same time I did in cardiothoracic surgery, I don't believe any of us had children, not that time. Things are very different now. When we were training, the hours were grueling. There are now training rules, hour restrictions so that you can, balance your work personal life. But back then, as women, we actually made a lot of sacrifices. But that said, the men were very accepting and encouraging, by and large.
And tell us what role your family played in your decision to go into this complicated field.
Well, I was very fortunate. I had parents that totally supported me. They were first-time immigrants to the Philippines. My father, my parents came here in the mid-late 50s, and really, my father succeeded from the ground up. I mean, he studied architecture, became a prominent architect, and was one of the millions of immigrants before him and after him who came to realize their dreams here in America. And so they were very encouraging, despite the fact that I chose such an unconventional field. My first choice when I was in high school and first year of college was really to become a journalist. However, I wasn't as good in English as I was in the sciences, and I had a passion for the sciences, which was really unusual. And I thought to myself, well, my father always said this to me, you have to do what you're passionate about, because that will get you through the ups and downs. your career. And so I thought, well, this is really unusual. But because of the encouragement from my parents, I went ahead and took this unconventional journey. I took the plunge. When I was in medical school, they continued to encourage me. And I can't tell you how many family events I missed, birthdays, anniversaries, you name it. And they were always understanding, never made me feel guilty about any of that. And so that's how I was able to continue this journey and continue my passion.
But you said you made sacrifices in your personal life. You mentioned that the women that were going into surgery at the time that you were specializing put off having families.
Yes, they did. One of the most amazing things I heard, and this was probably 10, 15 years ago, was during a board meeting of one of the Society of Women Cardiothoracic Surgeons, which is called Women in Thoracic Surgery. There was some background chatter about women freezing their eggs, so that they could plan more appropriately when to have families. And I thought that was fascinating and wonderful, something not available to us at the time. We made those sacrifices. However, I will say that, looking back, while children are wonderful, I gave it up to do something I had a passion for and that does save lives. And so, although that was my way of justifying it, maybe I was a little selfish in some ways. I love what I do. And so, I never looked back and had any major regrets.
So talk about saving lives. Last year, you completed your 650th heart transplant.
Yes, I did.
That's incredible. Can you tell us what it felt like to accomplish that as one of the few female heart transplant surgeons?
Well, I have to tell you, first of all, I always say this when I get any type of recognition, that how lucky I am to be recognized for something I'm passionate about. And how lucky I am to have the most amazing team, and it's because I stand on their shoulders that I accomplished what I did. It takes a village. And I have the best team I've ever worked with in my career. Not only are they at the top of their game, but they're pretty much as passionate as I am about what we all do. The more accomplishments that women have in our field, the better we can encourage other women who are contemplating this career, to not be intimidated, to take that plunge, because there are women who have accomplished such milestones, and some of whom have very high positions within cardiothoracic surgery. I'm so thankful and grateful, for being able to accomplish what I did with everybody's support. But I also am thrilled that we can hopefully encourage, again, more women to go into this field if they feel they have the passion for it.
Talk about your specialty. You specialize in left ventricular assist devices, or LVADs. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So there are 6 million Americans with heart failure, at least, and a great number of those, some predict about 500,000, have such severe heart failure that they really need help, either a transplant or some sort of mechanical device to take over most of the work of the heart. And since we can only do several thousand transplants a year because of donor shortage, that leaves a huge gap of people that could really die an awful death. Because when you develop end-stage heart failure and you're in the last year of your life, it is horrible. I mean, you're admitted to the hospital every few months, then every few weeks, not being able to breathe, and then you're done. And so left ventricular assist devices came into being way back in the 70s, but it wasn't until the late 80s when you could start to go home with the very, very first generation devices. So when I was training, we had those first generation devices, and it was proven to the FDA that could not only increase the survival of someone dying from heart failure, but it could improve their quality of life so that they're not dying that type of awful death. The problem is these first generation devices were big and clunky and they didn't last very long. They lasted maybe 3 or 4 years at best. And I knew at that time that they were developing the much smaller devices. So I am so thankful that, you know, this became a reality back in about 2008 or nine, where smaller devices were implanted and now they're even smaller and they last longer. It's anticipated that they will last possibly 15 or more years without having to be changed. We have a patient with not even the most a current device because hers was placed 14 and a half years ago. She's got the same device. We're fortunate to be part of pretty much all the FDA trials. So we get the devices before, you know, non-trial centers do. So it's because of that, that we were able to save her life 14 and a half years ago when she was only 29 years old. And she's already been, you know, in the news because she's one of the longer survivors. And at the time she had the device in, she had a, like a 6 or 8 month old son who's now a wonderful young adult. And to see what that device did for her, her life, her family. It's just incredible. There are thousands and thousands of stories like that. I think the youngest patient I put such a device in who survived was a 17. So, and the oldest was, I think, 80. So, you know, we've saved so many lives with these devices. And more importantly, we've improved their quality of life.
That's interesting. I mean, on a personal note, when I worked at Robert Wood Johnson Hospital in New Brunswick, we were growing the heart transplant specialty and promoting it. Mm-hmm. And we did stories on these devices being a bridge to transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. Now you're saying that they can replace transplant.
Yes. In many cases, they will actually, because as I said, there's a donor shortage. And in the olden days, when we had devices that didn't last as long, then they were more appropriately bridges to transplant, because otherwise you'd have to change them. It was a big operation. You know, now we have smaller devices that will last longer. And there's very, with the shortage of donor hearts, if a heart doesn't become available, you're still going to live a relatively long life and have a good quality of life. I mean, people go skiing. I've seen pictures of women walking down the aisle in beautiful wedding dresses. You don't know they have a device. It's just amazing. It really is. These devices are smaller than basically the palm of your hand almost, and they will take over the work of the failing part of your heart, and they'll just keep going. And there are very few, if any, device failures. So I'm pretty confident that this has, you know, really changed, you know, the whole environment for treating people with end-stage heart failure.
Can they be replaced?
Yes, they can. And the operation to replace them usually takes under 2 hours. It's very simple because, again, these are smaller devices and they're much more sophisticated. They've had a lot of time to figure out how best to design them. And so now there is a driveline, which I guess some people would call a lifeline, that exits your body and is attached to batteries and a computer, a little tiny computer controller that tells the device what to do. So the next quest in this field is to get rid of that driveline and have everything powered internally. And I think they're much closer to it now than they have been in the past.
That's terrific. What is your favorite thing about your work?
Well, I have to say it's working with an amazing team to see the patients' faces when they wake up from surgery and talk to their families. When you see a heart transplant patient after surgery, they're no longer gray or white, you know, they're pink. And the first thing they do is they tell you how grateful they are. And, you know, not uncommonly, I let the staff know who are involved with the operation, the transplant, you know, how the patients are doing and how grateful they are. Sometimes they'll come up to the open heart unit and say hello and say, I was involved with your transplant. And it's just an incredible privilege. And it's so gratifying to see. So to have seen that and done that so many times is just, it's exhilarating. It really is.
National Women's Physician Day is in February. What advice would you give to women who are interested in pursuing a career in medicine and to those interested in cardiothoracic surgery or heart transplants specifically?
Well, I would tell women who are interested in medicine that the time is really right. It's, you know, we have worked so hard in the medical field to try to assure a work-life balance and try to address any type of burnout, which, as we know, is present in every field, but particularly in medicine, where it can feel sometimes like you're just overwhelmed. All those issues are being addressed. They have been addressed. You can create the kind of life you want in medicine. You don't have to be 100% clinical. You can be 50% clinical, 50% academic, or whatever combination you want to create that work-life balance that will suit you the best. And also try to be passionate about what it is that you go after. In cardiothoracic surgery, I would, again, encourage women to join the Women in Thoracic Surgery Society, which is open to medical students, all types of women in training, to see if this is a type of thing that you're interested in, and not to be intimidated by the fact that you're a woman in a man's field, because we have achieved so much in this field as women. We will always mentor those women, who come after us. And so there's no reason to feel afraid about taking that plunge.
And I also wanted to ask you about heart transplant. You do heart transplant as well,
yes,
live donor
yes.
heart. Are we moving toward longer lifespans for heart transplant? Is there like a minimum or a maximum that you would say that the heart would do well in the patient?
Well, you know, whenever we show survival graphs, it shows that at 20 to 25 years, only 20% or less of donor hearts are still okay. Does that mean that the patients die? Usually. But in many cases, we can retransplant. For example, if you were transplanted young. So patients who were transplanted below the age of 30 the first time will usually qualify for a reevaluation for a retransplant, you know, if that heart fails when they're in their 40s or 50s. The younger the donor heart, the longer the survival of the donor heart usually. So in young patients, we try our best to put in young hearts, the younger hearts. There's, you know, in terms of a cutoff, I would say that there is a rare patient who lives beyond 25 years. There are some, but it's not common to live beyond 25 years with the same heart.
And the LVADs that you implant do not, you wouldn't qualify for that if your donor heart failed?
No, because, you know, the donor hearts, when they fail, they tend to get stiff, and the heart is just not anatomically, able to accommodate an LVAD usually. That's a very good question, though, because I've often wondered if there were instances where anybody's tried it. And I'll be honest, you know, the last literature search I did was a few months ago, and I hadn't seen anything published about putting an LVAD in a failed donor heart. I'm not to say that that can't be done. I think one thing that could possibly help deter the deterioration of a donor heart is, and I'm talking about something that's been studied for over 20 years, is, you know, if we made any progress with stem cells. but that hasn't happened. You know, we haven't had success with stem cells. We had a little bit of a temporary success back in 2006 to 2008, where people were paying, you know, out of their pockets to go abroad to get stem cell injections. But unfortunately, the results weren't long lasting. So, yeah, we haven't really gotten very far with that.
Okay. And finally, we should put in a pitch for donors. How can people donate?
Well, you know, it's actually very easy. It's, you can put it on your driver's license. That's really the best way to do it. Or you know, the other thing is to tell immediate family members who know your wishes. But it's the biggest gift you can give anyone. And after you've passed away, it just makes sense. You know, that you could possibly save so many lives. And so, yeah, it's extremely easy to donate. And I would encourage everyone, anyone. And if you're below, if you're a minor, you know, if you make your, and it's a tough conversation, I understand. But, you know, I lecture every so often to high school students through the Liberty Science Center. We always talk about this. You know, if you can at least have that conversation, if you feel strongly about it, have that conversation with your parents. So that, God forbid, something happens, you will have given life after you pass away.
Dr. Margarita Camacho, Surgical Director of Cardiac Transplantation at RWJ Barnabas Health, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Marla. Thank you so much.
I'm Marla Diamond. Please join me again for a journey inside the walls of New Jersey's largest academic health system on the Healthy Together podcast.
You've been listening to the RWJ Barnabas Health Healthy Together podcast, brought to you by RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. Visit them and learn more at rwjbh.org.